I'd like to welcome you back to the show. Somebody that, in my opinion, is a critical thinker extraordinaire that can see things from 30,000 feet and pick them apart, figure out what's wrong and what we should be doing different, is Ed Ring. He's a political and financial analyst. He co-founded the California Policy Center. He's got an undergraduate degree from UC Davis and MBA in finance from USC. He writes on a variety of topics, including political reform, sustainable economic development, and his work's appeared all over the place, including Wall Street Journal, Forbes, LA Times, and City Journal. Ed, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Andy.
Well, I got to tell you, I've got two pieces in front of me that you wrote just recently, and both of them have to do with growth. California has declared a jihad against no-growth communities. They're mandating that 3.5 million new homes be built, and yet they're not providing the water. They're not providing the freeway or highway capacity. They're not providing diddly squat. And nor are they owning up to the fact that one of the reasons we're behind in building houses is their fault with the California Environmental Quality Act and a lot of other things. And what you've done in these two pieces is just tear them apart along with this fake plan called smart growth, which is neither smart nor growth.
Well, that's right. It's neither smart nor it's growth. The theory behind smart growth is that if you put everyone into the footprint of existing cities, and let's not forget California is inviting the entire world to come on in. So all of the population growth that California is expected to experience in the next 10 to 20 years and beyond, under current policy, everybody has to live within the footprint of existing cities. And the only way to accomplish that is through so-called infill. And there's a lot of problems with this. Infill is something that, first of all, is never going to generate enough housing to bring a price equilibrium, down where demand and supply are back in balance. So we're always going to have overpriced homes if all we're allowed to do is infill. The other thing, though, is the fees. In California, just to pay what the so-called pure fees, which is the direct charges for various permits associated with constructing a home, it comes up to, in some cases, up to $150,000 or more per home. The lowest fees that we've found anywhere are still in the $50,000 range. So you're already adding that to a cost of a house, but that's not the only fees you pay. Whenever you develop any property, typically you have to, especially if it's an open field that happens to be within a city, so it's still raw land, you have to do all kinds of studies, and you have to pay for them. You have to pay for studies on a wildlife impact, all of the environmental impact. There may be some questions in terms of what the soil quality is. You have to do studies on how much park you need to construct. You need to even do studies sometimes on what kind of cultural amenities have to be added to the neighborhood in order to make it comply with standards now in California. These kinds of things 50 years ago, you'd build a subdivision and the land allocated for the park might not get developed for another 20 years, but everything was in place and people moved in and it was affordable. Now everything has to be perfect way in advance, and that's what's behind these fees. The other thing behind these fees, of course, is there's this insatiable need for funds because of the underfunded pensions in California. And people think that that's, an excuse. Oh, you're complaining about the pensions again. But if you look at the amount of money that comes into the pension funds, not from employee contributions, but from taxpayers, it's over $30 billion a year in California, and it's already scheduled to go to $60 billion a year, just based on announcements that have already come out of the big pension funds like CalPERS. And that's assuming we don't have a downturn in the market. So, you know, they're looking for $30 billion. That's what's behind all of these local tax increases, just to keep another $30 billion, I should say, just to keep the pension fund solvent. So the fees are a problem. But then you run into the mandates. You have to have, nowadays, energy-neutral homes by 2020. They have to be energy-neutral. Just putting solar on all of these homes adds $12,000 at least to the value of the house. So you have all of these problems with the cost of housing, but you also have a problem with the supply of housing because of infill. And the way to combat that is to stop claiming that it's undesirable to develop on open land outside of these urban boundaries. Why aren't we building entire new cities?
Yep.
We have all kinds of room in California. California has over 40,000 square miles of land that most of it's cattle ranching. And per capita consumption of cattle is actually dropping in the United States. The total head of cattle in the United States has declined since the 1970s, even though our population nationally has gone up 60% since then. So it's not even a question of, you know, you're talking about replacing land that's going to go fallow again anyway. It's land that's already been, you know, trod upon. It's already been interfered with. It's not wilderness. It's cattle ranching land. We're not necessarily talking about farmland. We're talking about grassland. And then there's all kinds of other land in California. California's got 165,000 square miles of land, and only 8,000 of that is urbanized. You could double the amount of urban land in California, and you'd only use up about less than one-third of land that's being used for cattle ranching.
Well,
One more thing, Andy,
okay.
Real quick. Think about what it would take for California to go 100% solar and wind. We did some calculations and determined that for California to generate enough renewable energy from solar and wind power during winter, when there's not a lot of sun, would require 10,000 square miles of land. Just build a few nuclear power plants and put houses on that land.
Absolutely. Let me bring up something. I'm actually going to a hearing this week on this. So the local agency formation commissions, which go by this Cortese Knox Bible, there was a push to use them to say, to enforce everything we're talking about. No more annexations. Cities would have to prove there is no more infill capabilities before they're allowed to expand and not, and if they expand on the ag land, they have to quote unquote replace ag land, which how do you do that? Because God didn't make any more ag land that's not already ag land. I said all that to say this. You mentioned, the fact that, you know, we could start new cities. That's true, but we could also leapfrog over the prime ag land, except that LAFCO says you can't have leapfrog development because they didn't want quote-unquote sprawl. So what happens in historically in farming valleys like Santa Maria and Lompoc here on the Central Coast and even Goleta, the development started on the valley floor. And then by definition, the valley floor has to get gobbled up before you can head to the hills, i.e. the grazing land.
Yeah, that's terrible policy.
And they need to change it. And I wish people, I don't have an audience like you've got an audience. I wish you could write on this LAFCO policy, because other communities, we used to drive out, when we go to out in the desert, about 5 miles before you get to Victorville, there's the city limits. And there ain't nothing but dirt and sand out there. So some communities just annexed everything, and they're slowly growing out. The ones that were honest and only annexed what they thought they could use in the next 20 to 30 years are now being penalized. LAFCO has to change the policy.
Well, there's so many policies that have to change. And you're right, that's a terrible policy because, again, there's so much available open land that, you know, not all of this land is critical habitat. And while I kind of agree that we want to preserve as much of our farmland as possible, the fact is agricultural technology is just beginning to explode. There is never going to be a shortage of food again. There's distribution problems. There's corruption. There's, you know, the rollout of technology is slow. But in the long run, and when I say long run, I'm talking just the next 10 to 20 years, there's going to be so much food because people are learning how to grow food indoors in high rises. It's food that doesn't require pesticide. It's food that can recycle. You can actually use sewage and waste to fertilize in a manner that doesn't have any kind of adverse consequences. You can do aquaculture in combination with what's called aeroculture or aeroponics and hydroponics. So the future of agriculture is so interesting, and it's simply false to suggest that we have to preserve farmland because we're going to run out of food.
Well,
there may be aesthetic reasons to preserve farmland,
well,
and that's fine, but we're not running out of food.
All right, we're going to take a break. Our guest, Ed Ring, you're listening to the Andy Caldwell Show. He's with the California Policy Center. Stay tuned. I'd like to welcome you back to the show. My guest, Ed Ring, co-founder of the California Policy Center. Ed, you know, the bottom line is what these enviros and the climate change crowd want is stack and pack, high-density housing, no yards, no place for kids to play, no place to park your car, traffic jams, and again, 3.5 million new homes, and nobody's talking about increased freeway or highway capacity. Instead, they're saying, nah, you build it near transit centers and with no parking spaces at all, will force these people to commute with on rail or bus.
Well, nobody wants to live that way, and the irony is this is terrible hypocrisy because the elite, you know, economic elites that are pushing this live in communities where, you know, a few neighbors get together. If somebody's planning on demolishing a home and putting a fourplex down, you know, they hire a couple of attorneys, they stop it in its tracks. But you go to a middle-class neighborhood or a low-income neighborhood and somebody comes along and gets a permit to demolish a house and put in a rent-subsidized fourplex, nobody can afford to hire attorneys. So they will be the victims of this, but the elites will be exempt. But, you know, I want to talk about the whole climate change argument, because even if you accept all of the theories of climate change, the studies that they cite, the so-called scientific studies that say sprawl creates more greenhouse gas, they're either just completely not true or they're very debatable, even if you accept the theory of climate change. And there's reasons for that. Cars, they say there'll be more transportation miles, but cars in the future aren't going to be emitting greenhouse gas. Energy sources in the future are not going to emit greenhouse gas. Upgraded freeways and smart cars will eliminate a lot of the traffic congestion that causes that greenhouse gas. Smart cars, share cars, drones are going to reduce the amount of surfaces, roads, and parking lots that we need. And single-family dwellings, they use a lot less energy in construction than high-rises do. The low-density suburbs have more trees. They have more greenery, big trees. They have a lower per capita heat island effect. And people are telecommuting nowadays. There's all kinds of reasons why you can argue against these studies that claim that urban sprawl causes more greenhouse gas. They're very, very much open to challenge.
Well, the other thing you brought out in these columns is the rest of the community ends up joining them. So I can remember when Camarillo was just Thousand Oaks, small town, still farming. Now, I don't like the farm fields getting gobbled up for a whole different reason, but I'll talk about that with you some other time. But nonetheless, the rest of the community followed. So, or look at Santa Clarita. It's got huge industrial parks. It's got shopping. It's got Thousand Oaks has a big entertainment venue and soccer fields. The bottom line is it was the suburbs, but they become citified so that people can, at least in some cases, get jobs there, not have to commute anymore at all.
The jobs migrate to where these people are living. That's exactly right. You know, farmland wouldn't be threatened if people were allowed to develop all the other open land.
Right, and we agree. Well, let me tell you the dirty trick Santa Barbara County plays. So we have prime ag land in our valleys. We want it protected because it produces, you know, I mean, just bountiful, bountiful crops, and we want to keep it that way. Sure. But here's the trick. What the county of Santa Barbara does, and a lot of these other ones do, they draw a line around, for instance, Santa Maria, and they say everything on the outside of that line is ag. It doesn't matter how steep the slope, how poor the soils, or if there's even any water, they call all the rest ag. And so then they say, well, you can't develop ag. Well, it should never have been zoned ag in the first place if it's too steep a gradient, no water, and poor soils.
Well, you're absolutely right. And that's a perfect example of how you could have, you know, kind of a jigsaw puzzle, a quilt of land development where the farming remains where it's really good soil, but if there's something like you just described where there's no water or it's a slope, why not have some homes? You know, the whole idea that low-density suburbs are bad for the planet is it's simply wrong. There's enough room. Population is stabilizing worldwide. There's enough room for people to live how they choose. And if they choose to have a yard, you know, we should be building the enabling infrastructure. We should be building more roads. We should be storing more water. We can use nuclear power or develop more of our natural gas resources right here in state. There's, you know, we should build desalination plants. That's where the public money should be going, is to infrastructure that will enable more housing on open land.
Well, and one other point. When my kids were young and we'd travel through the 126 corridor, I used to ask him, okay, where did the fire stop? The fire stopped where the orchards began. And the bottom line here is if we did do low-density development on these ranch lands and even in the forest areas, that those clearings, if you cleared enough back to what is actually sustainable, we wouldn't be having these catastrophic fires.
Well, you're right. Wherever there is a presence, human presence, you have more management, you have more responsible land management. Typically, of course, the environmental regulations made it very hard, and they started to reform that. But you're absolutely right about that. You know, the whole idea that we're going to, you know, it's simply, if there's going to be some kind of backlash, I mean, at what point, how many more million people are going to live inside existing cities? How many neighborhoods are going to be destroyed? How many people are going to be embittered and disenfranchised in their own, you know, neighborhoods where they might have lived for generations because of these cruel policies?
Well, you know what? I'm just remembering something. I think it was Stanley Kurtz who wrote a book about this, and a light bulb came in. One of the things he said is that these urban areas were inner city deteriorated hellholes, right? People move out of the inner city to get away from it all, and the cities are losing their tax base. And so he thought that one of the reasons they came up with this smart growth stuff is to force the development and the tax base back into the cities.
You're right about that. And the other reason, Andy, the other economic reason is when you artificially, you know, constrain supply and you force all this development into the existing cities, you're going to bring up prices, prices, and that helps all of the real estate portfolios in the pension funds. It helps wealthy investors. You know, it supposedly helps homeowners, but I don't exactly see why unless you're going to move and sell your home. There's an economic incentive to creating this scarcity, to forcing demand to exceed supply. There's an economic benefit, and especially for the economic elite.
Ed, thank you. We're out of time. I want to thank you for being with us. You're one of the best things California's still got going for them. I hope you don't leave, too.
You're too kind. Thank you very much, Andy.
All right. Ed Ring, California Policy Center. You're listening to the Andy Caldwell Show.